And good evening and welcome to this week's edition of Musical Theatre Melodies, a program which comes to you over the airwaves of 96.5 Inner FM every Tuesday evening between the hours of 9 and 11 p.m., hosted by yours truly, Rob Morrison. And welcome too to any international or interstate listeners we may have listening in via the World Wide Web. Well, my featured musical this evening is a 50th anniversary tribute to Dr. Doolittle, which had a screenplay, music and lyrics by Leslie Bricus, based on the stories by Hugh Lofting, and we shall be listening to the 1967 film soundtrack recording, starring the one and only Rex Harrison in the title role. But to introduce the musical, it's my very great pleasure to welcome back to the programme, via telephone from the south of France, the Oscar, Grammy and Ivor Novello award-winning composer, lyricist, librettist and screenwriter, Leslie Bricus. Good afternoon, Leslie.
Hello, Rob. Good to hear you again.
And it's good to speak with you again too. And you're enjoying some lovely sunny weather in the south of France.
It's one of the great summers down here. We've had 2 months of glorious sunshine, so no complaints.
Ah, great. Well, Dr. Doolittle was released by 20th Century Fox in cinemas worldwide in December of 1967, and I was one of many Australian children taken along to see it during the Christmas school holidays, and I still have the souvenir program issued for the occasion in the days when they used to put out programs for films. An interesting fact is noted in the program in relation to your good self. It states that your feat of writing the screenplay, music and lyrics for Dr. Doolittle is unequalled in the annals of cinema history. And of course, it's a feat that you repeated for the 1970s screen musical Scrooge. But would I be right in saying that even after 50 years, you still remain the only person to have single-handedly written all three for not only one, but two major screen musicals?
I have no idea. There aren't many people who write all three elements. I think there was a show once, a lovely show called The Music Man,
mm-hmm. yep.
and Meredith Wilson wrote the book, music and lyrics on Broadway. I don't know whether he wrote the screen version of it as well, but that's the only one I can think of.
Well, I think from memory, The Music Man film came out in 1962, so that would have predated Dr. Doolittle, and no doubt they would have made note of the fact, perhaps.
Well, we'll Google it after we've talked and I'll find out.
And Doolittle was only your third musical written directly for the screen after two British films, Charlie Moon in 1957 and Three Hats for Lisa in 1966.
Which I also wrote book, music and lyrics.
Uh-huh.
So that makes three.
Indeed, although for Three Hats for Lisa, I believe you shared a writing credit with Talbot Rothwell of the Carry On Films fame.
I wasn't aware of that.
Did he
wrote the screenplay. Well, whether they did anything with it after it left my hands, I've no idea.
Oh, I see.
Because I was in New York at the time doing other things. Anyway, it was only a little tiny show. Although, in that film, it was choreographed by our lovely Gillian Lynn, who was a lifelong friend of ours and came to fame with Phantom of the Opera and Cats, mm-hmm. which were wonderful achievements by her, now Dame Gillian Lynn.
Indeed, yes, and also one of the few films in which we heard the comedian Sid James actually singing too.
That's right. Another fine achievement.
But returning to Dr. Doolittle, apparently you weren't the first choice for the composer or lyricist of that particular film musical.
No, the whole idea of Rex Harrison was to create a reunion of the My Fair Lady team.
Mm-hmm.
Which would have been wonderful. But after their great success with My Fair Lady, they wrote Camelot on Broadway. And at the end of Camelot, a series of tragedies happened. Mossart died. Fritz Lowe had a heart condition. And I think Alan had a nervous breakdown, Alan J. Lerner. And they turned down the idea of a reunion, and so the producer Arthur Jacobs, for some reason, came and found me.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I note from his program notes that Dr. Doolittle was only his second feature film, and his first one was an all-star comedy called What a Way to Go.
That's right. That was originally he Apjack, as he was known, Arthur P. Jacobs. His company was called Apjack. Had been a very famous press agent in America, and What a Way to Go was meant to be a film starring Marilyn Monroe, with six major leading men
mm-hmm.
In tow, and she couldn't do it. So eventually it became, I think, actually, Marilyn was no longer with us by then.
Yes.
And Shirley MacLaine got the part, and it was at the time of Marilyn's troubles, which ended in her death in 1962 or three.
Mm-hmm.
That was the, it was 62 she died, and I saw all the memorabilia he had. Arthur had her passport, all sorts of things that would be priceless in the souvenir market, and he became a full-time producer at that time, and What Way to Go was the first one, and it's true, Doolittle was the second one.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any notion as to why he chose you to replace Lerner and Lowe on Dr. Doolittle?
Well, he knew Tony Newley and myself very well because he was involved in promotion of other things. But I think the reason, if there was a reason that it happened, he was following Tony's career and mine because we were writing book music and lyrics to our shows, Stop the World and Roar of the Grease Paint. And I happened to mention to him one day that I was thinking about a musical on Noah's Ark, and I had written several songs for Noah's Ark.
Mm-hmm.
And he told 20th Century Fox, I found a guy who writes songs about animals, and he may be the person for Doolittle.
Ah.
That's how it happened.
Uh-huh. But I believe Rex Harrison took some convincing that you were the right person for the job, and it's even reported that he approached the English Review writers Michael Flanders and Donald Swann to write some songs for the film.
Yes, they were very clever guys, but they wrote the wrong kind of songs. They wrote review material, which was amusing stuff, you know, I'm a GNU and
songs hippopotamus
like that.
Song, yep.
Yes, that wouldn't quite work for the style of musical that Doolittle was. And so it came down to me in the end.
Mm-hmm.
One interesting thing that emerged is that I auditioned for the show. They asked me to write the first 20 pages of dialogue and two sample songs,
mm-hmm. yep.
which I did. I wrote the first two songs so that it had a continuity from the beginning. And when I got to California, they put me in a beautiful house and gave me the 12 books of Dr. Doolittle by Hugh Lofting,
mm-hmm.
which was about 3,000 pages of words. So I thought, I'm not going to get into this that way. I've got to figure out another way to get into it.
Mm-hmm.
So on the first day, I thought, what is the film about? Let's get the basic idea going. And it was about talking to animals. So I wrote Talk to the Animals.
Mm-hmm.
On the first couple of days I was there, and somebody pointed out to me when it won the Oscar that I was probably the only person who'd ever won an Oscar on his first day in Hollywood.
A unique record indeed, yes. But Rex apparently had his qualms about Talk to the Animals, even up to the point of...
Rex was the nitpicker extraordinaire. I mean, he would pick a hole in anything, and he'd constantly say to me, you know, Les, when I became his friend, I became Les.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
He said, you know, rhinoceros does not rhyme with rhinoceros. I said, well... Well, of course, it doesn't exist as a word anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But he nitpicked that point for months and months. And eventually, he tackled everything he could think of. But eventually, when it won the Oscar, he said, well, you know, my song, Talk to the Animals, won the Oscar.
Oh, yes.
It became his song.
Oh, well, it's how he put it over on screen, I guess, that he could take the credit for.
Yeah, but he performed it, that wonderful Sprechgesang, that talking lyric. He better than anybody. He was wonderful, Rex. He was worth the trouble it took. And we became great pals. I mean, he had a lovely sense of humour, and he was a brilliant actor. And everybody said, well, he's not a musical person. But, of course, he was extremely musical
mm-hmm.
because his sense of rhythm was perfect. And when he sang on the note, it was always the right note, and he never had any trouble finding it. He was much smarter than people realised.
Yes, yes indeed.
Musically.
Uh-huh. And the role of Matthew Muggs in the film, was that deliberately written with your great friend and collaborator Anthony Newley in mind, or did he have to audition for the role?
Well, it's very strange. No, it wasn't. That was Apjack's idea, Arthur Jacobs.
Oh.
I had nothing to do with the casting of Tony. I was delighted that he did it, but it was entirely Apjack's doing, and I think he wanted the pair of us to be involved in the film. And Tony wasn't involved in the film because our second show, The Roar of the Grease Paint, was on Broadway, and he couldn't do both.
Mm-hmm.
So I did it instead, and it was rather strange to write for Newley instead of with Newley. It worked out okay.
Indeed, yes. And was the character of Matthew Irish in the original books, or was that something you added for the screenplay?
No, he was Irish in the original books, and of course Newley was not Irish in his original life, and his Irish accent was not ideal,
mm-hmm.
but it wasn't as bad as Dick Van Dyke's in Mary Poppins.
Oh, yeah. Indeed.
But it would have been nominated.
I believe you did a bit of coaching with the Irish accent too, did you?
Yes, well, I'm a quarter Irish, and so I'd heard some more Irish, obviously, than Newley had.
Mm-hmm.
And but he was lovely, and of course he delivered the songs beautifully. He was wonderful, and it was a good idea to cast him. I didn't think of it, but Apjack did. So it was we had a lovely group of people there.
Indeed, yes, and a great masterstroke of casting was that of Richard Attenborough in the role of the circus owner Albert Blossom. And I note from the souvenir program that Doolittle marked his first public appearance as a singer and a dancer, and needless to say, he acquitted himself extremely well in both capacities. So it's surprising he didn't make any further musical appearances after that.
Well, I take the credit for that one because we were having terrible trouble finding someone to play the circus owner.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a Welsh actor called Hugh something that they were thinking of casting. I'd worked with him on a film called How to Steal a Million. He played Audrey Hepburn's father.
Oh, yes. Hugh Griffiths, was it?
Yes, Hugh Griffiths. He was also wonderful in that film, oh God, that Albert Finney did early in his career.
Oh, Tom Jones, yeah.
He was wonderful in that. And he was a wonderful character actor, but he didn't have a musical note in his body anyway. So we were getting quite frustrated as it was getting near to the beginning of shooting.
Mm-hmm.
And one day I was sitting in my office at Fox, and out of the window I saw two sailors walking across towards the commissary. And one of them was Dickie Attenborough,
mm-hmm.
who's a great pal of mine already, so I immediately thought he could do it. He was known as Bunter. His nickname was Bunter.
Uh-huh.
So I rushed down into the courtyard and grabbed him, and I said, Bunter, how'd you like to sing a great big production song? And he said, for you, Brickman, darling, anything. I was known as Brickman.
Yeah.
And he came on board, and he did it. And the other sailor with him was Steve McQueen. They were making a film called The Sand Pebbles.
Oh, right.
Which took place in China. It was a wonderful film directed by Robert Wise. And so Dickie and Steve and I, we had lunch together that day. Steve invited us to his house for dinner that night.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the beginning of lovely friendship because Evie, my wife, and I were very close to Steve and Neil McQueen for years afterwards until their marriage unfortunately ended.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
He's a great, great guy.
Yes. And Richard Attenborough has a nice little moment in the film where he has the camera all to himself with a reprise of I've Never Seen Anything Like It. Was that in your original script or did you put that in because of the good job that he had done?
No, it all happened in one sequence. Herb Ross directed the musical sequences.
Yeah.
And there was no reprise. I mean, there was an extension of the song, but it was all in one section together. So I didn't know where that would have been.
Mm-hmm. Well, after the Push Me or Pull You becomes a great success, then Albert Blossom reflects on the money that he's making.
That's, right. That's all part of the circus sequence, yes.
Indeed. Mm-hmm. And the female lead, Samantha Egger, as Emma Fairfax, can you recall how she was cast in that particular role?
Well, I'm sure that the list began with Julie Andrews, I would imagine, and they went down the list until they found her. I remember I had to go to New York to meet with Barbara Streisand, and I said, Blackjack, you know, one thing Barbara is not is a young English woman.
No.
you know, her accent came from completely. Although, 2 or 3 years later, we got to know Barbara well. She's still our friend. And I taught her an English accent for another film.
Oh, yes. On a clear day, you can see forever.
There you go. There you go. That's what it was. And of course, I realized her voice was so finely tuned that she had the accent down in no time at all, which made me think back, this is Barbara Streisand, and she could have been the girl in Dr. Doolittle. But she was very funny about it. We had a lovely day in her apartment on the west side of Central Park. But it wasn't to be. It ended up being Samantha, who was another pal of ours from London. So it worked. It was all a nice sort of family feeling, and we still see Sam every year.
Indeed.
In L.A. when we're there.
Ah, great. Even after all these years, 50 years later.
That's mind-boggling. I mean, I cannot think that it can't be 50 years after anything, but it is. In fact, there's a lovely man in Los Angeles called Mike Mattesino, who his main task in life is to restore and get together on a double or triple CD all John Williams music from all his great movies. And the first one was Goodbye, Mr. Chips, which John was musical director of. I wrote the songs and John wrote all the other stuff. We wrote a lot of things together at Fox. We were kind of the in-house songwriters.
Yes.
All sorts of people. One of the great moments of my life was when my office door opened and Gene Kelly walked in and said, "Hi, Les." Gene Kelly, I nearly fainted. And he wanted John and me to write a song for a film he was making called A Guide for the Married Man, Walter Matthau picture. And then William Wyler came into my office to ask me to write a song. Everybody was talking about John Williams. Andre Previn, who was my first great pal out there, had decided to go and pursue a classical career with the Houston Symphony. It started.
Yes.
And he said to me, just before he left, he said, if you work with anyone, work with John Williams. He's the best. And how right he was. My God, when you look at that career, you know, 50 nominations.
Indeed,
50
yes.
50 nominations. Yeah, that's amazing. And his career with Spielberg, that association has been one of the, you know, he's the Mozart of the movies, John. He really is extraordinary.
Indeed,
and
yes.
A lovely man too, lovely man. So I got to work. We wrote songs for about 9 pictures over the years. Superman we did, and Home Alone and Hook. Some nice pictures as his career progressed. All sorts of funny films at the beginning. Goodbye, Mr. Chips was the first time I realized John orchestrated the overture based on a number of my songs, and it was absolutely fabulous, the overture, because of the way he orchestrated it. And they used it. There was a program that was on television here about 2 or 3 nights ago talking about John's great career. It was one of the Promenade concerts at the Albert Hall on the BBC.
Yes, yes.
And it showed the overture as the first inclination of what was to come from him. Even though it was somebody else's music, it was John's style. And I realized the same thing, because I also thought this was the beginning of the John that we came to know, you know, the wonderful things he's written since.
Yes, yes.
And that style was apparent then. Very, very interesting.
Oh, great. Well, returning to Dr. Doolittle, amongst the other cast was Geoffrey Holder as the native Chief William Shakespeare X, and he had quite a background as a singer, dancer and actor, and would go on to not only direct but also design costumes for the Broadway musical The Wiz in 1975, for which he won a couple of Tony Awards.
Yes, he's a lovely man, Geoffrey. he was perfect casting, and he was a very elegant man in every way. And we saw him more recently in the sort of 90s and 2000s, because we were both members of the Kennedy Center Awards Committee. Mm-hmm. And so we used to meet for the Kennedy Center every year.
Yes.
And he was a lovely man. The character of William Shakespeare the Tenth disappeared, thank God, when I wrote the stage version. He's now called Straight Arrow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as I recall from the film, Straight Arrow was the one who sent Dr. Doolittle the Pushy Me Pull You.
That's right, that's right. Uh-huh. And Straight Arrow, it's because his education, he went straight to Harrow.
That was the a play on words.
School. So from Straight to Harrow became Straight Arrow.
Right. And I guess as the screenwriter, you set your plot down on paper, and then the producer discovers that all these things have to be found and budgets have to be planned to accommodate such things as, well, a reputed cast of over 1,200 animals, and such things as a giant pink sea snail, a giant lunar moth, a seagoing schooner, and all sorts of paraphernalia and scenery and costumes.
Oh, it was a terrifyingly expensive film. Although it cost $17 million.
Mm-hmm.
Now, $17 million today, you couldn't get anything off the ground for $17 million. The cheapest film's 25 or 30.
Yeah.
So it's quite extraordinary how things have changed. But the budget was a concern, because I was not terribly keen that they were so anxious to make it a big picture. I would have not done the whole cruise thing in the second act, but if you wanted to introduce those exotic creatures, then you had to go somewhere outside England, because otherwise they wouldn't have existed. I mean, they're all fantasy animals anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I remember one budget meeting we had, the man called Stan Huff, who was the budget manager on the show. And he said, Leslie, it says here in this stage direction, the trees are filled with millions of singing birds. He said, do you realize how much that would cost? And I said, well, the trees are filled with three singing birds. And he said, that would be much better. So we cut $1 million out of the budget right there.
Indeed, yes. And I guess if the film were made these days, it'd all be computer-generated imagery. But back in, 50 years ago...
If only. You know, we have the 50th anniversary of it in L.A. at the end of this year, mm-hmm. where they're going to do it again, you know, and re-release it as an anniversary production.
Yes, great.
And... you realize, of course, how much CGI would have helped that film, but it didn't exist then, and so you had to do what you did, you know, as best you could.
Yes, yes, and all the animals.
With all fantasy things. I mean, when you think what they can do on the screen now, my God, it's wonderful.
So all the animals had to be trained especially for the film. Although I noticed in one sequence, looking very carefully, in Polynesia, the parrot has her leg pulled with a piece of fishing line to make her do the right thing. So.
Well, that's what I mean. That was as modern as it got. Thank God we have a piece of string.
Indeed. And as a screenwriter, how many drafts do you have to go through before you come up with the final product, and how many people in the production team have a say on what stays in and what should come out?
Well, that was the strangest thing of all. It's really hard to believe, but... there really was no second draft.
Yeah.
They bought the idea, and I tried to figure out what it was. Maybe it was the eccentric Englishness of the piece, but nobody actually, not the director, the only person with whom I talked a bit was Herb Ross about the staging of the numbers,
mm-hmm.
and,
yeah.
and Rex a bit about, you know, his dialogue, but there was no major rewrite from the beginning, which amazed me on a film of that scale.
Indeed, yes. Quite a luxury at the time, I suppose. And you might have got used to the thought that that's how they did things in Hollywood in those days.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it just always baffled me as to why somebody said, "Okay, this is the rewrite," but it didn't happen, rightly or wrongly.
Indeed. And you were talking about the exotic locations, and I noticed the filming location for the South Sea Island was the West Indian island of Santa Lucia. And it mentions in my souvenir program that they even had to bring in extra sand and palm trees for the beach location to make it look a bit more tropical.
Yes, the beach they chose was not blessed with a lot of sand, so they brought sand over from the other side of the island and made it look lovely, and then they found out that the sand from the other side of the island was full of nasty poisonous ants or something. So there was some horrible thing. It was infected, and they had to take it all away again and bring in sand from another part. So all those sort of things went incredibly wrong. And I think Santa Lucia was not the happiest experience, that location. I wasn't on the location because I was working on something else by then, but it was not a happy ride, that part. It's only 10 minutes in the film too. They were there for weeks and weeks and weeks.
And the other major filming location was Puddleby on the Marsh, for which they used the village of Castle Coombe in Wiltshire in the UK.
Castle Coombe has been, since time immemorial, called the prettiest village in England. And what they did was they closed in the river and made it look like a seaport. They managed to make the river wider at a section by the bridge, and it worked remarkably well. It really looked like a seaside village. And Fox made it more contemporary by removing all the television aerials in the place and burying them underground, so that the village benefited from that, and still the most beautiful village in England.
Indeed, yes. And I remember reading a number of the original Doolittle novels many years ago during my childhood, possibly after I saw the film, and I seem to recall they were contemporary to the time in which they were written in the 1920s, but you set the action of the film back to the early Victorian era of 1845.
Yep. I thought it felt more comfortable then. You know that Hugh Lofting wrote extraordinary how they were written. He was involved in action on the Western Front in the Great War, World War I, 14 to 18. And he wrote to his children these little stories as his letters. He didn't want to talk about the war, so to keep in touch with them and keep them interested, he wrote the stories that became the Dr. Doolittle books as little things to capture their imagination. It's an extraordinary way to begin what became very famous works.
Indeed, yes, and I believe that his wife kept the letters that he wrote to his children, and when he returned from the war he discovered that, and they decided to have them published in book form beginning in 1920.
That's lovely, yeah. I managed to acquire, 50 years later, this year, I managed to find at last a first edition of Dr. Doolittle, the first book, with a letter from Hugh Lofting in it.
Ah, quite fine.
Nice souvenir.
Indeed, yes, yes. And I believe in Dr. Doolittle, Rex Harrison repeated a process that he'd done in the film version of My Fair Lady by actually recording his singing vocals live on the set rather than miming to a pre-recorded soundtrack, which was the usual practice
in
those days.
It's taken nearly 50 years for somebody to do that in a film. It was done in Les Miserables, Cameron Mackintosh's production, Hugh Jackman. Les Mis, as a movie, used that technique of live recording. Normally, you did what were called playbacks, and the actors had to mime to the words.
Yes.
But Rex's kind of performance, that was not possible, because he was acting the songs as opposed to singing them. He didn't want to be trapped by the timing of the regular timing of a song lyric.
Yes.
It's not the way Rex worked. He would be in front of the note or behind the note. But he was able to give an acting performance which singers can't really give because they're on the beat all the time. And so Rex's technique, finally, they did a film and it was very successful in Les Mis.
Indeed. And I believe they used a very early version of a radio microphone when he sang on the set of My Fair Lady. Do you know whether they used something similar during Dr. Doolittle?
I don't know. I know that Rex did the songs the way he wanted to, and they accommodated him because they'd already perfected the technique in My Fair Lady.
Mm-hmm.
But if you think of any of the great My Fair Lady songs and his performance of them, he chose the right way. I don't think he would have done it if he couldn't, if he hadn't been able to achieve that way of doing it. Rex had a habit of getting his own way.
Yes, yes. Now, there was a bit of trivia on the DVD of My Fair Lady, and they said if you look in some of the scenes, you'll notice that Henry Higgins' tie has got a bigger knot than usual, and that's when he was using a radio mic to pick up his singing vocals.
There you go.
And we'll also get to hear a couple of songs that were included on the original soundtrack recording released in 1967, but were actually cut from the film itself, I guess to keep the running time down to a reasonable length. Where are the words?
Well, yes, because it was what was called a roadshow movie. It's a very weird thing. The theatre was so big in those days that they did films like the theatre. They had an overture,
mm-hmm.
and they had an intermission where they played random music from the score, and there was a 15-minute break because the films were nearly 3 hours long.
Yes, yes. I remember back in the 60s, there were quite a number of films where you used to have the interval in the middle.
That's right, but they were all shows like Camelot and My Fair Lady. They wanted to present a roadshow movie, as it was called, which was a filmed play, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I remember Chitty Chitty Bang Bang and the cars driving off the cliff, and then you'd wonder what's going to happen, and then it's intermission, so you had to come back afterwards to find out that it actually sprouted wings and flew. So.
I was responsible for the casting of Sally Ann Howes as Truly Scrumptious in that film.
Oh, great.
Everybody wanted Leanders for everything,
yes,
at that time.
Uh-huh.
And Cubby Broccoli, who produced it, came to see me one day at a house, and he said, "Who the hell can I get to play Truly Scrumptious?" And Sally Ann, who was the daughter of a famous musical comedian called Bobby House.
Oh, that's right.
We knew Sally very well, and I plumped for her, and thanks, but she got the part.
Mm-hmm.
But that's how she got it.
Indeed, yes. And interestingly, Bobby Howes actually finished his stage career here in Melbourne, playing Finian in the musical Finian's Rainbow. Yeah.
Oh, God. He was a wonderful performer. The first show I ever saw starred Bobby Howes. God, so far back.
Indeed.
in the 40s.
Oh, yes. I believe Mr. Cinders was one of his hits as far back as 1929. And appeared.
Yes, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Sally was at her peak in the 60s, but she performed musicals in the 50s and 60s and 70s.
Mm-hmm.
So that would have been the arc of it.
Indeed. And speaking of Julie, of course, you involved her in your stage adaptation of Dr. Dolittle when it was presented in London back in 1998.
Yes, that was just a fun thing. You know, we spent a lot of time, Jules and I, because I've known her since Mary Poppins. I mean, you know, we've been great pals, and also she was married to Blake Edwards, with
yes,
whom I was working a lot because of my relationship with Henry Mancini. With Hank and I wrote sort of songs together,
mm-hmm.
and all of us did Victor Victoria together.
That's right.
Which was a lovely piece, and I forget, I was talking to Julie one day, and I said, "Would you like to play the parrot?" And I said, you know, and I said, well, if Angela Lansbury can be a teapot in one film, you can mm-hmm. be this in the other. And she came along, and we had great fun. She was in London. She did it wonderfully.
Mm-hmm.
Just for a laugh.
No, I believe all her dialogue was pre-recorded, so I guess it was up to the sound engineer in the theatre to cue it in on
yep.
each night.
Exactly. Exactly. That's how it's done.
Including, she has a couple of lines to sing in Talk to the Animals, but I guess...
Oh, yes, no, she squawked her way through the whole song with Philip Schofield played Dr. Dolittle, and he was very, very good, Philip.
Mm-hmm.
He made it work very well. He was a much younger, more glamorous Dr. Dolittle. We have another stage version, a new production, going together right now, which will open next year in England. I've made one or two changes to the story in this one.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't like the idea that Samantha, who was, what, 24, 23, 24 at the time, and Rex, who was sort of almost two generations older, certainly more than one generation older.
Yes.
So I've developed the romance between Matthew and her so that those songs can be better presented.
Oh, okay.
Than with Rex's involvement. They're now mainly duets between Matthew and Emma, as she's called. And I think that's a big improvement in the show. It gives a good romantic quality, which you didn't have in the film.
Yes, because I guess it was more platonic, a la Henry Higgins and Eliza Doolittle, rather than an explicit romance. Yeah,
exactly.
Mm-hmm. Although, did you develop the romance in the first version with Philip Schofield and his leading lady? Because he was
entirely new. But it doesn't involve any rewriting of the songs, but it does affect five or six songs in the show, which it makes a big difference musically, and it's much stronger in this version than in any other version. So I'm pleased with that.
Indeed, yes. And one of the songs cut from the film was Where Are the Words, which was sung by Anthony Newley as Matthew in trying to think of the words to say to Emma.
Yes, that remains Matthew's solo. But other songs like Beautiful Things become a duet now, and it makes a lot of things build their relationship more even than the dialogue in the film.
Yes.
And I'm quite pleased with it.
Indeed. And you write in the notes to the London production that it was actually Jim Henson of Muppets fame who first broached the idea of turning it into a stage musical back in the 80s.
It happened. Roger Moore, James Bond, invited me. We've known each other all our lives, Roger, and very sadly we lost him a couple of months ago. Roger was doing Talk to the Animals on the Muppet Show, and he asked me to sort of go with him to hold his hand in case any unforeseen happened.
Mm-hmm.
And we went out and we had lunch with Jim Henson and Frank Oz, who were the creative team, and they asked about doing Dr. Doolittle as a stage show.
Mm-hmm.
And of course it would have worked because they were who they were.
Yes.
But I had always seen it a different way. I didn't see the creatures as Muppets. I saw them being more realistic than that for us to believe the story.
Yes.
And then shortly after that, we'd already done the film, but I had a stage version in mind, and I don't think it would have worked as well for me had it been Muppets, as opposed to you create a different kind of thing with Muppets because the dialogue becomes different,
mm-hmm.
and more jokey, and I don't think that would have worked.
No,
because I wanted to believe it was real, that story.
Yes.
I didn't want to think it was a kind of made up fantasy story. I wanted it to be believable, if you can believe a fantasy like that.
Indeed. Yes.
So we didn't do it.
So rather than having talking puppet animals, you just wanted them to be natural animals, all apart from Polynesia,
yes,
of course.
I mean, it's insane, because to turn down anything involving Jim Henson and Frank Oz was madness, but I chose to go that way.
Mm-hmm.
Frank Oz became a very good film director, you know. I'm sitting up here in my room looking down at Antibes, and in Antibes, Frank Oz directed Michael Caine and Steve Martin in a film called Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
Oh, yes, yes.
Uh-huh. Dirty Rotten Scoundrels about 20 years ago. And that film went together very quickly. We had lunch with Mike one day, and Frank Oz was there, and Steve Martin was there. And 3 months later, it was out.
Oh.
They had a very tight schedule, and it involved just mainly the two actors.
Yes.
And they came down here and whacked it out very quickly. Mm-hmm. And it was very funny, very good film.
Indeed, lovely, yes. And I believe it's Jim Henson's son who runs the Henson Creatures Workshop, which was responsible for creating the animatronic animals that were ultimately used in the London stage production of Dr. Doolittle in 1998.
Yes. Oh, yes, it was a wonderful man called John Stevenson. Yes. I recall now. Lovely, lovely guy, John. And he did. We did all sorts of... In fact, strangely enough, going back to how I got Dr. Doolittle in the first place... John Stevenson and I were working out how to do Noah's Ark.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So the thing that got me Doolittle ended up working with the man who went back to Nosocomy. But it still hasn't happened, though. It's a very tricky one. I love the idea of it. And it's written and ready, but one day someone will do it, hopefully.
Oh, well, I guess they could do it as an animated feature, perhaps, even computer animation.
We've been talking about that idea. Mm-hmm. So we've got two possible chances. One is a stage show, and the other is as an animated movie.
Mm-hmm. Oh, great. And do you think with the London revival of Dr. Doolittle next year that we might even see it in Australia eventually? Because I recall you telling me that John Frost, the producer, wanted Anthony Waldo to do it in Australia, but they discovered that they'd lost the original animatronic animal, so they had to cancel the project as being a bit too expensive to start from scratch.
Well, I've always wanted to work with Anthony Waller and indeed John Frost. John Frost came to London and was at one point was going to do an Australian production of Jekyll and Hyde, which I wrote with Frank Wildhorn. Mm-hmm. And that's now unbelievable success, strange as it may seem, in the Far Eastern countries. It's in Japan, and it opens tomorrow night in China.
Ah. Uh-huh.
It's the first time in South Korea it's played for years.
Yes.
And yet it has yet to play London. It's been on Broadway, it's been all over the place, Jekyll and Hyde. We've yet to play it in my hometown.
Oh, that's extraordinary.
It's always being talked about, but it still hasn't happened.
Mm-hmm. And when they do it in Asia, do they do it in their native language or in English?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
Evie and I were going to, that was in Shanghai tomorrow, and Evie and I were going to go over until we found out it was in Chinese. We've been told it was in English.
Uh-huh.
And we've seen the show enough times not to need to hear it in Chinese. I wish that I wished them well.
Yes. Quite a bizarre experience, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, we saw it in Japanese. We've seen it in Korean.
Uh-huh.
Only in English on Broadway.
Mm-hmm. Oh well, hopefully it'll get on in London and also come to Australia too. There was a projected production of it.
Yes. Well, John Frost was interested, and of course the idea was if it had been Anthony Warlow. Because Anthony recorded the definitive recording of Jekyll and Hyde.
Indeed,
which
yes.
Is a double CD that we've got. It is wonderful, wonderful voice. But he was not well back in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
When we first tried to do it. It's amazing how long ago it is. And we've talked about it again, but it's a very demanding role because the lead actor plays Jekyll and Hyde.
Indeed,
and
yeah.
it's a mad ride for the actor. And it's a nightmare for a singer to do eight times a week.
Exactly.
And that's why it's difficult. In Korea, they have two actors play it who are both stars, and they each do it four times a week, which is more manageable.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Great. Well, I guess we'd better wind up this conversation because I notice we've been speaking for 3/4 of an hour, but it's been a very great pleasure to speak to you, Leslie. And we'll be able to...
Lovely to hear your voice again, Rob, and I'll see you or hear you next week.
Indeed, yes, when we'll speak about the 1982 Chichester Festival Theatre stage adaptation of Goodbye, Mr. Chips, which starred John Mills, of course, another old friend of yours.
Indeed. Lovely, John. I look forward to that.
And in the meantime, continue to enjoy that lovely summer weather in France, and we can but envy you.
I wish we could send you some by FedEx, but unfortunately we can't.
Oh, well, we'll have our chance in about 6 months' time or thereabouts.
Yeah, then you can send me some.
Indeed.
Okay, Rob.
Great. Thanks very much, Leslie, and bye for now.
God bless. Bye-bye.
And I've been speaking with the Oscar, Grammy and Ivor Novello award-winning composer, lyricist and screenwriter Leslie Brickus. Well, let's pause now in our program for some community service and sponsorship announcements before returning with tonight's presentation of Dr. Doolittle from the original 1967 film soundtrack recording. You're listening to 96.5 Inner FM.